Welcome, guys. This is the Mother Earth Heroes show. Today, I am here with Nick, my co-host, and we have the pleasure to talk to Anders Wickman. And Anders has a very interesting story, ranging from working at various corporations and organizations to now being the chairman of Climate Kick, as well as being a member and actually one of the founders of the Club of Rome, or at least one of the leaders in that organization. So thank you for being here. Hi, Anders.
Hi. Good to be here.
We want to give a little bit of a of an overview of who you are. So you have written the book Come On, co-written it with Ernst von Weizsäcker, who we already also had on the podcast. And he said something very interesting, that it is actually one evolutionary step to limits to growth. So who doesn't know what limits to growth is, it's one report based on a computer simulation that was taking into consideration the economics and the population growth, also taking it as really putting it into the frame of comparing it with our finite supply of resources. So you, as the honorary president of Club of Rome, as the chairman or one of the chairmen of Climate Kick, we really want to go deep with you into the whole transformational factor. A lot of our guests were talking about we should do that, we should do this. We were talking with a lot of people that were helping us to get a better grip of the system. But we saw one video in particular with We Don't Have Time. You were holding a presentation there, and you were talking about these are minor progresses that we made in Europe, reducing our CO2 emissions by 20%. And you said that's not enough. We can't make this our excuse that we're making little progress. What we need is transformation. And based on that keyword, now that you are here, how does that transformation look like? What can we expect in the next 10 years?
Well, I think my main point in the talk that you referred to was really to distinguish between, on the one hand, incremental change and transformation. Yeah. And incrementalism, that you can do within the present system. You can cut, you can become a little bit more efficient. You can cut away emissions here and there. But if you really want to move towards net zero in terms of emissions, you need something different, totally different. And I think the problem is that most policymakers, they don't really understand the difference. I think many of them think that we can continue to do what we have been doing over the last 20 years. That is to say, cutting here and there. But that's not gonna be sufficient. We are not going to succeed by that. So we need to look at all the major sectors where you have emissions, and that's basically society at large. You have to look at every sector and realize that you have to rethink how you do things. I mean, transportation is the most easy one. You have to go from combustion engines using fossil fuels to either fuel cells or electricity. That's a real transformation, because you have to change the engines, you have to change the fuels, etc., etc. The energy system is also quite easy to explain, at least the electrical system, where you have to move from using coal, oil, and gas to generate electricity to something totally different. Renewables mostly, but for some people, maybe also nuclear. But in my case, mainly renewables, plus, of course, storage capacity so that you can deal with the intermittency. I mean, it doesn't blow all the time. The sun is not up all the time. So that's a challenge, but I think we can solve that. Then you have all the rest of the energy mix. I mean, let's not forget, electricity is less than 20% of the energy mix. Even if we electrify the transportation sector, you still have a lot of areas where you still use fossil fuels. And there you have to rethink what you're doing and to come up with other solutions. Then you have materials. Basic materials are huge in terms of carbon emissions. Steel, cement, plastics, aluminium, textiles, electronics, 25-30% of carbon emissions. And it's not only that you need energy in the process. For some of these materials, you need fossil fuels. I mean, you cannot produce steel unless you have coal and coke in the process to deoxify the ore. Plastics is made from oil and gas. Textiles, polyester is made from fossil materials.
Yes.
So I mean, there you have a challenge. Either you innovate and you have new materials, or you substitute. So you go from maybe steel and cement to wood in construction, or you develop the circular economy, where you use materials not only once, but many, many times. And for some materials, that is totally feasible. Metals is one example. Plastics is different because you lose in quality. But these linear production models are of course obsolete, not possible. So we have to rethink in every bloody sector. I could add the agriculture as well.
One thing that I find quite important is, of course, we have these sectors and they have to transform, but where is this, is that really the root cause? Like, for example, I was in New York at the Climate Action Summit, and there I was with a group that is called Sustaining All Life and Ending United to End Racism. And they were going quite deep into systemic change as of the system as a whole, and with about the word system, really, how we understand the word. And they were having quite great arguments of why racism is actually part of one of the causes of climate change. Mm. So the question really is there some kind of really radical change needed so that we start to think different what a state is, think different about borders, or you know, what is really the root cause of this transformation? And is it just that we take a look at industries and be like, okay, we have to make the linear economy now circular? Or is it that we beforehand have to put some kind of root out of the earth and then change it from the ground up?
Well, I mean, of course, what I the examples I gave were short-term oriented. I mean, we need to cut emissions now, and we need to do it drastically. And then you have to start looking into the major sectors and how we do things and try to do them differently. One aspect is, of course, to ask yourself some of the consumption patterns that we have developed are really not responding to basic needs. I mean, fast fashion, for instance, nobody really needs to change clothes all the time. Consumer electronics, we don't need to change our mobile phones every 18 months. There is a lot in the consumer culture and the business models, and they are very much linked together, that you have to question. And in some areas you have behaviors or practices that are totally unnecessary. I mean, you don't have to fly to meetings all the time. You can have virtual meetings. So you can satisfy needs in different ways. And I think that's one of the more challenging tasks, because there is a tendency today when we look at emissions that the incumbents, those who are offering different production and consumption systems, they are the main respondents. And they, of course, want to continue more or less business as usual and change it a bit on the margin. And some of the transformation that we need will probably not come through the incumbents, through today's dominating business or companies. It will come through startups. It will come through individuals who imagine to satisfy needs in a different way. So from that point of view, I agree with you. We have to take a much broader look at the system than just look at what we do today and try to twink it on the margin. Then, of course, in addition to that, you have the whole capitalistic system and the fact that at least as it's presently organized, it leads to widening gaps between a rather small group in the top and the rest of the population. I don't think that's sustainable. I think it will erode trust in society. So we have to rethink many things, absolutely.
Talking about the system, we have the feeling, and that is what we experienced as well in some talks already, that there is an old system which is still alive, really, really powerful. And what is happening actually with the new generation, new mindset? You talked in one of your talks about that people don't want to earn things anymore so much, but it's much more about the service and how much we can enjoy using products and not anymore that it's our product. So there are a lot of changes coming in mindfulness, exponential tech, like a lot of buzzwords going around, and there it's like a curve going down and up again. And we wonder always in the podcast to get a systemic understanding, where are we at the moment? Is this old system really dying, or is it guys jumping around in the world wishing for a better world and spreading somehow a love, but in reality it doesn't even look closely like that? So where are we at in this transformation in the system, and where do we get the capacity to foster this new emerging system?
Oh, that's a big issue, big question. I think we are on the verge of something quite different, primarily because of what we call exponential technologies. Digitization of the economy opens up a lot of new opportunities that didn't exist before. To move towards a service-oriented society, replacing products with services, was not really possible until you had the smartphones, because the smartphones make many of those services possible. So technology plays a major role here, and in particular when we talk about generic technologies like digitization, AI, machine learning, which will impact every bloody activity in society. It's like electricity some 100 years ago. It changed everything, and this technology is also changing everything, and it's changing everything in an even more fundamental way. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at facial recognition and biometrics, and what that can lead to in terms of a surveillance society. So there are enormous opportunities, but also enormous risks. And my problem is that I don't see that people in general really understand what is at stake. And I don't see that most politicians really are in a position where they can put in place legislation to avoid some of the risks, to steer technology development in a positive way. I think we are going to have a lot of difficulties because of this. But by all means, it's going to be a very different society, absolutely. But you could say that it's a bit sad that this transformation is primarily due to technology developments, not due to evolution in terms of mankind becoming more developed or more mature.
So what we always wonder is what we see all around us are young people with the energy and the lifetime, you know, they can still spend to which really want to understand it and change it for the better. And do you have the feeling that that this generation raising up at the moment is equipped enough with all the possibilities we have from e-learning, amazing or not so amazing, whoever you want to ask, universities, and like all that what equips us as young people? Do you have the feeling that we have the capacity already enough to give it the right spin in the right direction, or is there something fundamentally missing what we still can add to the system?
You know, I it's difficult to judge because I'm old enough to have been lecturing for young people about the challenges we face for many, many years now. Mm-hmm. And it's only very recently that I experienced this enormous response, positive response among young people. I guess it has to do with timing. It has to do with the Greta Thunberg effect, etc. I'm just amazed about all these young people who are very dedicated to do the right things, etc. Whether they are a majority or even a qualified minority, I don't know. Because I also see a lot of young people who continue more or less like before, who are not sustainable in their lifestyles and don't really seem to opt for it, to strive for it. So I find that we have a parallel cultures right now among young people. I can only hope that the ones who are consciously now trying to move towards sustainability are going to win. But we don't know that. I think it's too early. And the difficulty, of course, is that since we are talking about the system, we need system change. We need transformation. And we don't have the institutions today to enable that because we have a very silo-based society. And if you look at governments, the different ministries are also very silo-based. They work in parallel to each other. They very rarely cooperate like this.
Mm-hmm.
They defend their turf, so to say. I see that all the time. I mean, in particular, when we work on the circular economy, it's not only an issue for the environment ministry. It's an issue for the industry, industrial ministry. It's a matter for the finance ministry. But there is a tendency that each of the ministries they defend their own agenda and they don't let the others in. So that's why this transformation is going to be difficult because we don't have the experience, the institutions that we need.
One question in regards to that is a lot of people are asking themselves, since it feels like we are at the brink of something, that Fridays for Future is really like the first wave of change to come. Just seeing this threat that gets more clear the more time you spend just looking at it. Thinking like in a history perspective, what we're facing is not unique, right? We had disruptions of the system all the time, but now it just seems that we're pretty comfortable of how it is, and it's pretty working well on some sides of the world better than on others. But in general, we're getting more wealthy, have less poverty on the world. So things are working pretty well. But the question is, do you think we need a transformation of the existing system, or do we need a disruption of the current system to make move so that a new system can take place and really bloom, which would mean that we have to disrupt it and stop it, what is working.
We already see or experience disruption. I mean, that's for sure. And that's because of technology, but it's also because of globalization, the way it has unfolded. And we experience populism in different parts of the world simply because the present system is not it's not looked upon as fair by an increasing number of people. And then populists are very keen to try to benefit from this lack of trust among the population. I mean, it's ironic that in the US, the widening gaps between a little percentage of the people and the rest of the population, and the fact that poor people have become poorer, the middle class has stagnated, salaries have been stagnant or going backwards for decades. It's ironic that a guy like Trump is benefiting from that, because he has no solutions to those kind of problems. He is mostly interested in making rich people richer. But he's been clever as a demagogue utilize the lack of trust and the frustration that many people feel. And you could say that to some extent the what's happening now in the UK around Brexit has the same connotation. But I think that you can say that disruption is taking place, but whether it's going to be enough for a transformation to happen without a major crisis, I don't know. If you look at history, major transformations never really happened in a peaceful way. They always were linked to some kind of major crisis, warfare or whatever. Because I think we human beings are very short-term oriented. Mm-hmm. We have difficulties planning for and making decisions for the long term, and that's why we even when we see some of the IPCC scenarios, when we look at some of the evidence from biodiversity being eroded, ecosystems on decline, even if we can understand that, we have difficulties to really change the system. And many people say it has to get worse until it can get better. And they are probably right, unfortunately.
Talking to you and talking to Aarons, I have the feeling like you guys are in a way system hackers. You know, you are like, when we would just put a world in a box of good and bad, you are the good guys still playing a big role in this whole system. You know, you're involved in big decisions and talking to people who have really influence, and you can really in talks have a huge impact more than when you're not into this talks. You are sometimes into with a Club of Rome people, for example, as well. And what I wonder is, how could a world look like where we foster all of this energy of the people currently like wanting a better world, and we can really give them the skills you guys have? Like, what are the skills needed to operate in the surrounding you are operating right on at the moment? And because that could maybe set the right impulses again, right? To foster to really get this change done, when just more people, more bright people with more energy go into this direction. So where are they? Where are these facilities to get them out?
Well, you know, I shouldn't exaggerate our influence. But both Ernst and I, we have lived long lives. We have been both in politics, in science. I've been in the humanitarian sphere. We've been in NGOs. We've been experienced society from many different angles. We've got to know a lot of people, and we have probably built some trust around what we do. So, and that's not something that you can acquire just like that. I mean, it takes time, both to get the experience and to build the trust. It takes time. Mm-hmm. And we are invited to give speeches and to participate in debates, etc. It also takes time until you have that, unless you are Greta Thunberg, because she climbed the ladder very, very quickly, so to say. But what I would like to say is that the most, I think, important component of our message is really that everything is interlinked, that everything is interconnected, and that you cannot solve any of the problems or challenges we face with a singular mind or with the vertical solutions or single point solutions. You have to take a look at the system and realize that things are interconnected. And that's difficult, because institutions are not built that way. And by the way, the academic community is not built that way. Mm. You know, you make career as an academic within a rather narrow discipline. And even if many academics speak in favor of interdisciplinarity and working together, when they come back to their institutions, they are rather narrow in their approach. So I mean, there you really need a revolution. And by the way, in our book, we try to look at, we take our entry point in the scientific revolution in the 17th and 18th century. And we applaud it, because it was a very important step in the right direction. We put knowledge at the center in society. It paved the way for democracy and human rights and you name it. But it was very reductionistic. It was very reductionistic. And we are suffering from that still today. So to move from reductionist to systems approaches is, I think, the most important thing to do. And whenever Ernst and I give speeches, I believe that what we convey is this more systemic view. And that's unfortunately still quite rare. And whenever I meet with young people, I say, look, if you are an economist, if you are an ecologist, if you are do this or that, please reach out to the other disciplines and make sure that you get a more holistic view. And if you take the SDG agenda, the 2030 agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals, if you try to pursue them issue by issue, goal by goal, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. If we start by growth and jobs and don't care about climate and ecosystems, I mean, we're going to continue to destroy the planet. So we have to have a more integrated approach. That's for sure.
You're writing in the climate emergency plan you write about a team, a global team, which is mapping out and seeing where new things are evolving, and to really have this holistic view you're just talking about, like this people who really can go into the bird's eye perspective. Is there already an operating team? Is there already a company, a team, or something what you wrote about in the emergency plan, similar to that, operating into the world, which we could have a deeper look into to really understand what does that mean in the end, to have a more holistic view without being a generalist who gets nothing done anymore, right? How to really have this broad view without just talking.
Yeah, I think there are some, of course, there are individuals, but there are also some institutions. I think the Potsdam Institute for Climate Studies is one. Mm. I think the Stockholm Resilience Center in Stockholm is another. They have a I think, very broad view. I think also that an economist like Kate Raworth is and her Do Not Economics is a third example. And then, you know, there are individuals in the academic world like Tim Jackson, Peter Victor, etc., also members of the Club of Rome, who try to work in this more systemic way. I'm also struck by the fact that some business organizations are also moving in this direction. I think the World Economic Forum is moving in this direction, part of it. Mm-hmm. I also think that Climate Kick, where I'm very much involved myself, we have a CEO, Kirsten Dunlop, who has developed what we call systems innovation. Not looking at individual technologies, rather looking at the broader set of technologies and organizational solutions. So, I mean, it's coming now, but it's late in the day, so we have to speed it up. But I think it's coming. It's coming. I just mentioned a few that if I would sit down and you know, reflect on it, I would probably come up with 5, 10, 15 more institutions.
Nice.
Do you feel it is quite institutionalized, meaning that the barrier of entry is sort of reserved to people that are part of a community? One community, the scientists, don't usually speak to the policymakers. So a policymaker probably doesn't know when a scientist is working on some institution that they could also benefit from. Like, do you feel that there's some kind of communication issue that people just know that these things exist, but if they knew, they could go there?
Well, I think one of the problems is that there is a lot of arrogance in the world and also ignorance. I've spent almost 20 years of my life as a politician. And one of the things I noted was that most politicians seem to think that they don't have to learn much more. I've noticed that when I've been participating in conferences, seminars, workshops, where the main objective is to share new knowledge and to share new ways of approaching problems and challenges. And I've experienced how difficult it is to have policymakers stay for the whole seminar and to really learn. They come, they attend for a few hours, and then they leave, as if they were only there to tell the world what they think themselves, not to listen to others. I think that's a major problem. And I also think there are too few meeting places between policymakers and scientists. And they must work together, because scientists are not very good at understanding the difficulties to implement policies. They know pretty well what has to be done, and they convey that you have to stop this, you have to do that. And if they met more regularly with policymakers, I think that would crystallize better implementation strategies. So I think, again, that we have to build bridges between science and policy. And that's very, very important. And I've experienced it the hard way as a policymaker. You know, politicians, they are bombarded by information around the clock. And there are all kinds of reports coming. Yes. And they almost drown in all this information. And in order to stay afloat, they need to have some kind of insight into important reports that emerge. So I always said, when I was a politician, that when I talked to the UN, for instance, I was always saying that if you're now going to do a report on this problem or that problem, and you set up a task force mainly of world experts, scientists, why don't you link to that or accompany that with an advisory board or a sounding board or policymakers? Let them meet with these experts every second or third month for half a day and be informed about the work. So once the report is out, you have some allies in the political system. And I saw it when it comes to the ecosystem assessment, global ecosystem assessment in 2005. Was a very important report. There were thousands of scientists had been involved. And when it hit the policymakers, there were very few of them who understood the report because it was long, it was complicated to read, etc. So yeah, I think you have to experiment trying to build bridges between these different communities. That's very important.
Building bridges. Maybe just to share an example, maybe a perspective that could also be interesting for you, because from our community of young entrepreneurs, we have this certain ratio of we become rich first, become millionaires first, and then we change the world. Maybe when you say there are these institutions out there, these people don't know them. They want to have an impact. Many from our community are on their way to become a millionaire or whatsoever to then clean up the ocean. We also think that there's like this communication issue in many different spaces where people could become part of the solution, but they just don't know how. That's a bridge where we see that could be a problem. Like, do you think this is actually something that is needed in the world? Or is that just from our limited perspective, something that we think our perceptions are what we can now focus on?
I fully understand what you say. And I very much welcome all these young entrepreneurs who are keen to help address some of the challenges and come up with good solutions. And that's why I think, again, the political system, whether we talk about the European Commission or individual governments, they have to organize innovation work in a way that they can help attract young entrepreneurs. We are trying to do that in Climate Kick. And I also think that the European Commission is now moving in the right direction. They have identified a number of missions, very important challenges, where they say, okay, we are going to allocate a lot of funding here, but it has to be done in a way that we can be relatively sure about results. And they try to build innovation ecosystems, which consists of both academics, entrepreneurs, startups, cities, etc. Cities are important because they are very often the problem owners, and the problem owners must be in the center and tell the entrepreneurs, tell the scientific community, here are the problems we need some help with. Please come and work together. So I think that's a different way of organizing innovation than we have done in the past.
Maybe Anders, going into the ending part of our podcast, when we would think about a moonshot, you know, like we talk to people who are wanting to take over some small island, not take over in a brutal way, but more in a political way, and say then here we're gonna make and state here some role model for a country which can be in a sustainable, circular way with a really, really cool ecosystem for the people living there. Like, what is the moonshot you believe is needed? Like, is there a role model needed? Could Sweden, for example, turn into a role model of a society which the world really wants to understand how Sweden did that? Like, do you have some moonshots in mind you're thinking about which really can bring this transformation in rapid speed instead of like that we are just keep being in some meetings and nothing really is happening in the speed we all
know. I wouldn't say that Sweden is a role model when it comes to circularity. Unfortunately not. I think we are lagging behind. I think Finland and the Netherlands are more advanced because they started early and they have done a lot of interesting work, both at the national level and also at the city level. There are cities in the Netherlands, Amsterdam, Utrecht, to name a few that are quite advanced. The city of Helsinki is also quite advanced. And of course, we need role models. We need good examples. I believe very much in that. And I think that small nations, they very often can develop such role model capacity easier than big nations, because they are more homogenic and it's easier to agree on things. So that's why, and you know, when we developed the climate strategy for Sweden, the long-term strategy, I was chairing that task force. We were, and all the major political parties were part of that task force, and we were in unison about one thing, and that was that on the one hand, we are a very small nation. Our emissions are marginal compared to the whole. So the biggest impact we can have is by offering solutions that others can follow. That is to say, to be a role model. And I think we are, to some extent, trying to offer that. For instance, in the field of steel making, we have now a very interesting project run by the Swedish steel industry, the biggest utility, and the biggest mining company called Hybrid, where the idea is to use hydrogen as a reduction measure instead of coal and coke in the future. So leave behind the traditional steelmaking, where you have a lot of carbon emissions, in favor of something where you have no carbon emissions. And if we succeed in that, that's going to be a role model. And that's going to be easy to sort of share with other countries. So I think that's very important. But in the circular economy, I don't think we can brag about it.
And what is your moonshot? What is your specific, like, do you have a moonshot in mind? Something where you working on day and night somehow?
You know, there are a few issues which are needed to address if you want to move towards greater circularity. One is costs and prices. As long as it is less expensive to source virgin materials as compared to secondary materials in most sectors of the economy, companies are going to continue to source virgin materials. So that is an issue of how we price externalities.
And as long as we don't do something for that? Can I ask you regarding that? Because you have working in the government, as you said, and we were talking before about this chicken egg problem of the government raises the prices for waste, for CO2 emissions, but then they are scared that the companies will go just out of the country and say, all right, and we just produce somewhere else. Is that valid?
That's of course, that's the whole issue of competitiveness. And industry will always tell the governments that if you do that, we will either go bankrupt or we will move to China or whatever. Mm-hmm. In most cases, that's not true. We have a good lot of studies that shows that countries where you've had relatively more ambitious environment legislation, including taxes, have over the long term become more competitive, not less competitive.
Interesting.
So that's the first point. The second point is that I don't think an individual country can do this alone. I think, but the European Union can do it. It's the European Union is big enough as an economy, more than 500 million people. And we have seen when it comes to the chemical legislation that once REACH was adopted, the chemical industry didn't die. On the contrary, other regions started to take after and adopt more or less the same policies. So I think, but you have to do it in a clever way, of course. The second issue, which I think is very much needed, is to accept a principle that products that are put on the market in Europe, if we limit ourselves to Europe, they should normally be easy to dismantle so that you can reuse components and or materials. Because it's a colossal waste today and a lot of pollution, unnecessary pollution, because we only use material once. And that's a big, big problem. It was possible to do in what Ernst and I in our book call the empty world, when we were relatively few people and the planet looked infinitely large. Now we are almost 8 billion, moving towards 10 billion people. We cannot continue to use resources this way. So design criteria plus taxation, those are the two major issues. Then you could add, of course, public procurement, that the public sector, when it purchases, should set an example and go for circular products and services.
When you're looking now, when you're looking from today on, let's say we have a machine and we pull a trigger and we are all 20 again. We are 20 years old. And we are looking at the world, how it looks like today, and you have still the knowledge you have today. Where would you specifically go? What path would you choose with all the knowledge you have now to have the biggest impact with your time and your energy?
Well, if I was 20 years young, I would go back into economics. I would try to have a PhD, and that PhD should be aiming at rethinking economics from the point of view of the planetary boundaries. Because I think the tragedy is that conventional economics has helped us very little. And I quote a famous British economist, Cameron Hepburn, whom we were together in a seminar a few years ago when we talked about the education of economists and that they learn absolutely nothing about nature. And at the end of the day, the life-supporting systems we find in nature, and if we don't manage them with care, we are going to go bankrupt. By the way, I wrote a book called Bankrupting Nature with Johan Rockström a few years ago. And then Cameron Hepburn said, well, I'm sorry to say that economists today, they are educated as if the last 30 years didn't happen.
So
I would go into economics because I think that is the dismal science. And you know, look at Nordhaus last year. He did receive the economics prize, so-called Nobel Prize in economics. And still he is a guy who doesn't seem to believe in climate change the way most natural scientists believe in it. He says it's too expensive for us to cut emissions below 3.5 degrees of warming. Jesus Christ, that's another world.
What is then hindering us from actually changing? Because that's what we question ourselves, looking at this world, looking at the system. Because when we think about it, all economic principles like the GDP, taxes, these were inventions of someone or a group of people that was thinking, all right, cause and effect, we should do something. So why isn't there at the moment someone who says, all right, guys, like GDP was nice, but somebody who invented it 100 years ago probably should update it. Or it should be updated now. And like, why is nobody there stepping up in the economic game and actually bringing forward this implementation? Because it's just a mental construct that has to be implemented, doesn't it?
I don't know. Well, there are some economists, to be fair. There are some economists. And Nick Stern, who is famous for the Stern Report in 2005, 2006, and who was the first leading economist who really try to integrate climate change into economics in an understandable way. He wrote an article the other day saying, you know, crying out to his colleague economists and say, where the hell are you? Why don't you help? Why don't you help shape a better model? So I mean, there are exceptions, but most economists are, I don't think they don't understand. And they look upon nature more or less as a constant. And, you know, when they talk about pollution, they talk about external effects as if it was something very, very marginal. Now the marginal problems are the major ones. And we should really, yeah, we should really ask ourselves, why is economics so badly taught? And that's why I would go into economics, because I'm not a PhD. So whenever I debate with leading economists, they look at me as somebody who doesn't know. So you need certain credentials. So that's why I would would be the path I would choose.
Anders, are you disillusionized?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, you know, people often ask me whether I'm an optimist or pessimist. I mostly respond by saying I'm a possibilist, because I see a lot of opportunities. Mm-hmm. And to be a pessimist doesn't really help. Of course, I have my bad days. And sometimes I'm really frustrated, because it's taken such a long time to really wake up the world. And now when there is a wake up, we still have a lot of difficulties to implement the right policies, and to shift mindsets, because that's really what it's all about. But it's happening, we just have to hope that we will do the right things in time.
How can we bring together the wisdom, people like you, who really used their lifetime, all of their energy, you're still using your energy to really make an impact, a remarkable impact on how we as humanity are evolving? How could we glue with this energy coming up with movements like Fridays for Future or Extinction Rebellion from a really, really, I don't know, from the growing up people now? Like, is there something which brings us together, or is there, do we need to have more such conversations just in a bigger frame, you know? Like, because I believe you have collected so much knowledge, so much wisdom, that we could build up now as young people on the shoulders of titans out there. Mm-hmm. Happening already, or that is there more to be done?
No, I think you're right. And I think we should identify meeting places between, let's say, my generation and mm-hmm. those who have gained some experience on the one hand, and young people. And the Club of Rome and Climate Kick as well, we have reached out to Extinction Rebellion. We have reached out to Greta Thunberg and her peers. Mm-hmm. And the important thing, I think, is that these groups of young people, mm-hmm. that they have good advisors. And I happen to know that Greta has very good advisors. Kevin Anderson is a leading climate scientist, and I know that he has been advising her. So I think it's very, that's very important. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I agree with you. I don't have a formula, but I just think we should organize more meeting places, absolutely, and help each other.
Brilliant. And as we want to respect your time, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with our listeners and also with us. Is there one thing that you want our community to do? Is there something, some kind of call to action? Can we help somehow?
Yeah, I think, because I don't believe that we will do revolution in the classical way using arms. I think we need revolution by changing people's mindsets, etc. And I know that many young people are interested in many of these issues, but they tend not to really be interested in going into politics. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the membership in political parties is going down all the time. So, and I think this is a problem. So we have to, reinvigorate party politics. We have to make it relevant again. And I think young people don't give up on politics, rather help change it, help modernize it.
Is there a tip for someone who's starting out really ambitious in politics? Because the feeling I guess young people have, at least out of my perspective and the people around me, is you go with a lot of energy into politics, and the first thing which is happening is a big wall in front of you will appear, and it's really, really hard to go up in the structures to really go into a position where you really can do something. So I think, would you rather say make your own party, or is there a hack? Have you found a hack for yourself to hack your way really fast up into politics that people, I mean, we demand fast change. We demand it by yesterday, right? So I think people won't be satisfied to go now for 5 years until they're in some kind of place where they can do something important, right? Maybe that's an issue as well, but to where can they really have the spirit and people will lift them up in politics? Do you know anybody who helps in that?
No, not really. And I don't think there is a standard answer. I think each and every country has its peculiarities. But yeah, I maybe starting on new parties is not a bad idea. Because if you compare party politics with the market for goods and services, in party politics you find more or less the same parties as was there for 50 years or 100 years ago. In the marketplace, you have all time new mm-hmm. companies, new startups, etc., that develop new offerings. So I think we need more competition. And so new parties is not a bad idea.
You wish for a political system that is more like a free market? Like...
No. Well, yeah. No, but I think we need, you know, ideas and concepts that are no longer relevant should be outcompeted by concepts and ideas that are more fit for purpose. And I can see, I mean, look at social democracy today in Europe. It's trying to survive. It was doing wonders for societies some 30, 40, 50 years ago. Today, it's struggling to find its way. Just one example. The Christian Democrats is more or less the same. I mean, those parties are 100, 150 years old, and they somehow have difficulties to renew themselves. So maybe new parties would do a better job. I think so. Yes. But those are just examples. But you can also, I mean, in some instances, you have strong people who enter into a party and change it. And that's, of course, also possible. I'm just saying that don't give up on politics.
We love that message.
We're going to find right now.
Okay. Thank you very much. It was very, very nice talking to you, and good luck with your pod.
Thank you.